Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news ad free. That's amazon.com/news ad free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
It's How Do We Fix It with Richard and Jim.
Solutions for the opioid epidemic. Sam Quinones.
And then I realized, well, the reason these guys have such a big market for their heroin is because of this change in our prescribing practices by doctors all across the country. Because these drugs are chemically very, very similar. They're all derived from the opium poppy. Their highs are the same. They're very good painkillers, but they're also extraordinarily addictive. They have the same withdrawal symptoms as heroin does. So heroin is a replacement drug for them if you can find it cheaper.
How do we fix it?
Jim, it's hard to overestimate the destruction, the suffering, the pain caused by America's opioid epidemic. It's an addiction crisis like no other the country has faced.
Yeah, and it's really striking how it didn't really become really front and center in the national conversation until surprisingly recently, even though it's been going on for such a long time.
And maybe that's because the media is based in big cities like New York and Los Angeles and Washington.
And this is happening out somewhere else.
Absolutely. Yeah. Since 1999, 200,000 Americans have died of overdoses related to OxyContin and other prescription opioids.
Right. So let's take a deeper dive into this problem and see if we can come up with some solutions.
We're speaking today with journalist Sam Quinones, author of the highly praised book Dreamland, The True Tale of America's Opiate Epidemic.
It's a story that began in the 1990s with Purdue Pharma's marketing of OxyContin, a new treatment for pain that proved to be highly addictive, but it also involves a massive influx of black tar heroin.
Sam Quinones joins us via Skype from Los Angeles on very short notice. Sam, thanks for joining us.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me on.
You say this crisis began because we sought easy answers to a complicated problem, pain management. Tell us more.
Well, yes, I think Americans in general began to want easy, uncomplicated solutions to things. And I think this spread over into medicine and how we viewed medical treatment. One of the most complicated things that doctors have to do is treat our pain. And so an easy answer, because also we were being told that these pills were now known to be virtually non-addictive when used to treat pain. These are pills that derived from the opium poppies.
And some of this research that suggested that they weren't particularly addictive, you look back and found out it was based on some extremely sketchy reporting.
Right. There was no scientific basis for this idea. And that what they were basing it on were a few very sketchy reports. They were not studies by any means. One was actually a letter to the editor, but yet were taken by these pain specialists and pharmaceutical companies who were making this argument in the late 1990s as proof that science now knew that these pills were somehow non-addictive when used to treat pain. Pain is a deep mystery. It's very complicated to deal with. It's as much an art as it is a science, is my understanding. But one of the things that really comes across as you talk with doctors about this is that a lot of pain management would be far easier if Americans made better consumer choices of what they consumed and their exercise. And also, during these years, doctors in general had fewer strategies they could employ because the insurance companies stopped reimbursing for things like acupuncture and marital counseling, which can sometimes be part of a person's pain.
Can we just simply then blame aggressive marketing by the drug companies, particularly Purdue Pharma, or is it more complicated than that?
I think certainly that's one place you might look, but I also believe it is more complicated than that. I believe Americans wanted this, and they pestered their doctors. And the doctors, you know, the doctor-patient relationship is a very delicate thing, and doctors are there trying very hard, most of them, to help their patients and wanting to be liked and wanting to be helpful.
And in many cases, over the last couple of decades, doctors came to be measured by various patient satisfaction surveys as well, right? And if you're, some of the questions might include things like, did the hospital or the staff do everything they could to help you with your pain? And doctors who got bad scores on those, they could actually be hurt in their compensation.
Absolutely. That was a lever through which patients essentially extorted pills from doctors, if you ask me. It became that, I would say. Certainly as evaluations, they're virtually pointless. All they ask is a few questions, one of them being when you ask, but it doesn't really give you any data upon which to improve the appointment or improve the hospital service. And patients, particularly the ones who were most insistent upon getting these pills, were demanding, and they would use those evaluations. And lots of doctors mention this. This is not something that's isolated. It's all across the country as doctors and hospitals were increasingly forced to kind of toe the line when it comes to these evaluations. To my mind, it's one of the things we could change, really.
Now, the opioid epidemic began with these prescription painkillers, but then many people got hooked on illegal drugs such as heroin.
Correct. And that happened for a variety of reasons. One was that their doctors would see that they were out of control in their use of pills and would stop prescribing. Others, they would lose their insurance and not have any money to pay for the pills. And others would simply get addicted and switch to heroin because they just wanted a slightly more powerful high. But all of these pills were prescribed to somebody, whether you bought them legitimately or you bought them on the street. So the enormous new supply that the doctors are prescribing, a lot of that leaks its way out onto the streets and makes up a black market. But that's unsustainable. That is unsustainable because these pills on the street, the black market for them is $1 a milligram, usually. And you're doing 100, 200, 300 milligrams a day that you can't pay that much, $100, $200, $300 a day. So people switched to heroin, and that's where our heroin market had also shifted.
Tell us about how you first came across this dimension of this crisis.
I started this story really because I was interested in why heroin traffickers from Mexico would be doing such good business. I just assumed that heroin was a drug that no one would ever want to do again. I thought it was almost going to be extinct. All of a sudden, they're seizing more heroin than ever at the border. There's more use. And so I got into it because I wanted to write about Mexican heroin traffickers. And then I realized, well, the reason these guys have such a big market for their heroin is because of this change in our prescribing practices by doctors all across the country.
But I still don't quite understand this. Why would people go from black market painkillers or legitimate prescription drugs to heroin? I mean,
these drugs are chemically very, very similar. They're all derived from the opium poppy. Their highs are the same. They're very good painkillers, but they're also extraordinarily addictive. They have the same withdrawal symptoms as heroin does. So heroin is a replacement drug for them if you can find it cheaper.
Is it usually cheaper? Is that the big incentive for people to switch over?
That was another part of this story, that in the 1980s, it became just remarkably cheaper than it ever had been. And that was because our heroin market stopped being supplied by the Far East, by Turkey, by Burma, Thailand, those countries. And that heroin was really outcompeted by the heroin coming from Mexico and from Colombia, really today mostly Mexico. It gets here much quicker, much shorter distance, and therefore is much, much cheaper.
Before we talk about solutions, I'd like to know a little bit more about what this epidemic has done, not only to families, but to communities. Tell us about a city you wrote about, Portsmouth, Ohio.
This has destroyed families, destroyed many parts of this country, just ripped it apart. I fastened on it because it was the place where they invented the pill mill, which is a pain clinic in which you're really just selling prescriptions. There's no medical diagnosis. But the history of Portsmouth that led to this is that it used to be a real strong industrial town making steel, shoes, a variety of things. And a lot of people, 50,000 people, a strong, vibrant Main Street, locally owned shops. All of that slowly begins to just fade away as the jobs leave, as the factories leave, as half the population leaves. It always seemed to me that just as the Indians were very vulnerable to smallpox when the Europeans came over, so too folks who remained in Portsmouth were very vulnerable to this horrible scourge that was then visited on them because they were right in the area where these pills were first promoted by pharmaceutical companies. And a whole generation or two, really, of people in Portsmouth, Ohio, got addicted, and it killed many people. It destroyed families. It really destroyed a lot of economic activity. It was a horrible plague that was visited on this town.
Our guest is Sam Quiñones, the author of the book Dreamland, The True Tale of America's Opiate Epidemic. I'm Richard Davies.
And I'm Jim Meggs.
And this is How Do We Fix It?
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
So let's talk about what we can do in terms of treatment. And what have you seen that looks promising?
I think one place that we really need to look is jail. As we have entered this scourge, this plague, this epidemic, it's a cliche now to say that we cannot arrest our way out of this, which implies that we are going to treat our way out of this, which I doubt is going to be possible. But nevertheless, what that means is we need to then expand treatment. Well, most people don't want a treatment facility in their neighborhood, and it takes a long time to site and build, and they're costly. And by the time you've got certainly if it's private, by the time you've got it built, the folks who most need it can't afford it because they don't have insurance anymore. So where do we look? If we need it quick, cheap, easy to build or already built, where do we look? And I would argue that one place we should look and is being looked at is jail. Jail's been done one way, badly, for many, many, many years, which is to say we put people in jail. It's a parking lot for humans, boring beyond words, predatory at times, bartering, a lot of weird sexual stuff from time to time. All of this very tense, very stressful. And think of what happens. An addict gets off the street, detoxes, gets all those drugs out of his system, is finally thinking clearly, realizes that his girlfriend has left the state with their daughter, mom won't take the phone call. There's this clarity of what he has done becomes clear as soon as he detoxes. And it's at that very moment, usually of great contrition, that we put that guy into a jail that is boring beyond words, predatory, stressful, a lot of bartering, a lot of gang stuff, a lot of violence, all that.
That is the worst place to put that guy. I think that we need to rethink jail in America.
So what do we do? Today.
Yeah. Talk about what's going on in Kentucky, because that is an example of a solution, or at least a way forward, right?
Sure. The way I got onto this was I visited the jail in Kenton County. As it turns out, a good 25 jails in Kentucky are doing this. And they have transformed a pod, a 70-man pod is what I saw, into a full-time rehabilitation clinic. Pretty much every service that you would get in a private outside treatment center, you're getting at this one pod. You have to volunteer, but you wake up in the morning, 8 a.m., you make your bed military style, and for the rest of the day, you're not sitting around watching TV, you're not sleeping for 10 hours a day, you are working on your recovery. Criminal addictive thinking classes, GED classes, working out, time for prayer, meditation, NA meetings.
NA meetings, meaning Narcotics Anonymous?
Yes, right. And so what you see is something I've never seen in a jail, and I've been in a few jails in my life, is an attitude of nurturing. Jails have not been nurturing places. They are brutal, they're predatory, they're boring, they are anything but nurturing. But in this pot, you're seeing nurturing places, which by that I mean guys helping each other forward. Come on, brother, we're in this together. There's not the same preying on people who show weakness. You start crying in an NA meeting, you are not going to be raped. I saw a guy stand up at a meeting and read a poem. Never would you be able to read a poem in a regular jail. You'd be mincemeat.
Right. So what happens to these inmates when they get back on the street? How is the program working in terms of recidivism?
I think it's working better than the alternative. It is not, of course, a panacea. There is no panacea to this. And so these are extraordinarily enslaving drugs we're talking about. They make life torment for the people. And so some people, yes, get out and they don't quite make it. I should add that this jail also offers reentry services, so jobs, sober living houses, Vivitrol, which keeps you from overdosing. They offer these services as well. Some people don't make it, but I think they've done studies on those folks who have left, and there are higher incidences of the things that would keep you from relapsing. There's better connectivity with family, greater likelihood of being employed, greater likelihood of living with your family. A variety of things like this they've seen. It works. It works very well. Some people are ready to make it work. Other people get out and they struggle. I would say, though, however, that it seems to me self-evident that this is a better way of using taxpayer money than the old way, which is almost pushing people to relapse, to run straight to the dope dealer's house as soon as you get out of jail because it is so stressful.
Another area is drug courts. I
yes.
know there's an example in Buffalo, New York, for example. Are they making a difference in some places?
Oh, I think so. I think this is a recognition that a lot of people's crime is directly related to their addiction, and the best drug courts require significant accountability on the part of the person who's asking for his or her record to be expunged or a felony to be dropped to a misdemeanor. And that means you have to be always going to meetings, you have to have a mentor, you have to be looking for work, you have to be doing all these things, you have to be meeting these. But in return, you are not treated as a festering sore, you are treated as a human being, you are treated with an interest in your best outcome. Which is what I've seen in some of the best drug courts. Addiction recovery, in my interviewing with people involved in it, it requires accountability. You must be meeting standards, and it's when you stop meeting those standards that problems begin to
rise.
Right,
right. So one of the themes that you've expressed is that there's not just one solution. It's going to be a suite of solutions. And what I'm hearing from you is that's also true for individual patients. It's not enough just to have one type of therapy. This is a whole life problem. And so something that integrates having a job and some kind of social support as well as drug treatment, all those things have to go hand in hand.
Absolutely. You know, I was in a clinic, a neonatal clinic, where a lot of infants have been born and are addicted and are withdrawing. You know, and the nurse said to me, do you know what these infants need more than anything? And I said, no, what's that? And she said, cuddling. They need to be cuddled. What does that mean for an addict? What it means is every addict cannot go it alone. You need to be surrounded by services and people who can make you feel as if you're not in it alone, who you can turn to when maybe things get hard, who are with you, that there's this community of help around you, mentors and what have you, that will help you through that. Trying to do this alone is disastrous. It almost never works. But you understand, as you dig into this story and this whole problem that we have nationwide, that this is a story of isolation versus community. The reason we got into this is because as Americans, we're extraordinarily isolated, both economically, physically, geographically, politically, going on and on and on. And the response, it would seem logical to me that the best response would therefore be community. By that, I mean a variety of approaches to addiction, a variety of approaches to prevention, using all the different ways and people we have in a certain county or town, leveraging those energies, leveraging those talents and that expertise into something. We have not been doing that. We've been working in silos, every one of us, and so many agencies, so many groups, so many nonprofits, we just work alone. And to me, it feels like the overarching idea, a theme to this problem, is that we must begin to start breaking down those silos and working together and leveraging all that energy and leveraging all that talent. It's out there, but we have not, you know, in isolation, all problems seem insoluble.
And speaking of silos, I mean, what can most of us do? One thing that pops out here is so many of us, after operations, have maybe a lot of stuff in our medicine cabinets.
Yeah.
Pill disposal. Is that part of what we should be talking about?
Of course it is. We have these massive amounts of drugs out there, and they get stolen. They get diverted. Kids come over to the house. They take them. Whatever it is, there's a million different ways these drugs get diverted and create the black market that we have today. Remember, all of these drugs, virtually all of these drugs, were prescribed to someone at some time.
Right. So, Sam, you've seen some of the worst of America and some of the saddest stories that are happening in our society today. You've also seen some really important and inspiring work and inspiring people. And you've spent a few years on this huge crisis in writing your book. Are you optimistic?
There's reasons for optimism and pessimism, but I do believe that this is one of the great moments of our history, honestly, that can show us that by coming together as Americans, forgetting the polarization that is so much on display on this 24-hour news, cable news that we seem to love to endure, and coming together as Americans, you see the great reasons for optimism in counties where people are just putting that stuff aside and deciding they're going to be working together and participating in different groups that you might not think involved in an anti-drug problem, you know, get involved. PTAs, trainers, little leagues, Kiwanis, churches, etc. All these different groups kind of coming together. That's where you see the wonderful, beautiful, exhilarating part of this country. You can see a whole bunch of other not so exhilarating parts in this issue, but this issue allows us the opportunity to come together as Americans, to put behind us all that crud that is force-fed to us on 24-hour news and a variety of other ways, and become Americans in community. Again, we have destroyed community in this country in a million different ways, all across the country, and heroin is what you get when you do that.
Sam Quinones, some kind of beautiful remarks there in closing. Thank you. The author of Dreamland, thanks for joining us.
Certainly my pleasure, guys. Thanks so much for having me.
There were so many moving moments in this interview, but for me, when Sam Quiñones said it's about isolation versus community, I think he was really on to something. And then arguing that because this is so complicated, it has to involve many different parts of the community, from voluntary organizations to social workers to obviously doctors, and also to patients and to how we talk to our doctors.
Well, I know this is a favorite sort of theme of yours, is that, you know, we do need individual responsibility. It sounds harsh, but there is there's a role for the choices that people make before. Obviously, once people are addicted, you know, they need help. Nobody's going to solve that on their own. But the path that gets them to becoming in that position, you know, people do have a role in that. And he talked a lot about, you know, there's certain kinds of chronic pain that have a lot of social elements to it. If you're unemployed and you have a back problem, that back problem is a lot more likely to endure and not go away. And then if you can get, you know, if you're getting a steady supply of pills for that, maybe you're not as quick to go to the physical therapy or to do the work that you need to do to handle that problem. As he was saying, it's so much easier to go for the pills. So there's a role for all different aspects of society, but also for individuals to, you know, make the choices that help reduce the likelihood of falling into this kind of condition.
Personal accountability is crucial to the success of any program. A couple of things he didn't talk about, and this show is not going to deal as much with policy as perhaps it might in this, but I do think there's a role to, for instance, the federal government saying to insurance companies, you got to make safer alternatives to opioids less expensive than they are today.
Right, right. Here's where I come back to on a lot of these issues. It's very easy to demonize people, demonize the doctors, the evil drug companies, and believe, honestly, the drug companies do have a lot to answer for, you know, to demonize the addicts. But every social problem also has incentives, many of which might seem pretty harmless. He talked about those doctor evaluation surveys people fill out. Well, that seems like a good idea. I mean, if 5 years ago, if you talked to people and said, like, should doctors be evaluated on the quality of the service? Sure, empower the patients. And then you see these incentives have these unexpected negative consequences. So we need to really make sure we get in there and change the incentive system so we're not encouraging them to overprescribe, encouraging patients or giving patients the power to coerce doctors in that way. These are not solutions to the whole problem, but these are small things that can contribute.
It's How Do We Fix It. I'm Richard Davies.
And I'm Jim Meggs.
And our producer is Miranda Schaefer. And our music is composed by Lou Stravinsky. We are a production of Davies Content. Davies Content makes digital audio for companies and nonprofits. Check us out at daviescontent.com. And thanks for listening, as always.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.